Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. I'm joined in the studio now by Kelly McEvers, NPR correspondent, who until recently was Beirut bureau chief, covering the conflicts throughout the Arab world and Middle East. You've likely heard her riveting stories from the heart of the Syrian conflict. And while that conflict goes on with major developments today, Kelly is transitioning away from war reporting. She's back in the U.S. and has produced a new one-hour documentary called Diary of a Bad Year, which explores life as a war correspondent and what it is that keeps conflict reporters going back into battle and risking it all. That's a new radio documentary. Let's talk about that documentary and the latest news out of the Middle East. Kelly McEvers, welcome back to WNYC and welcome back to the United States.
Thank you so much.
I first want to get your reaction to the terror alert that we've been hearing about in the news this week, the closing of 19 embassies, evacuations from Yemen, reports of top al-Qaeda leaders planning a fresh round of attacks. What are you making of this news?
You know, I mean, I think one of the things we need to make of this is that, you know, I think we felt like we defeated al-Qaeda in the region and that we thought there were just these kind of franchise groups all over the place and we could easily deal with them. I think now the message is, we can't. We're seeing really the resurgence of these groups in places like Iraq. They're obviously gaining ground in Syria. And this is a worrying trend. I think in Iraq, when American troops pulled out in 2011, there was a sense that, okay, you know, we've really got a handle on these guys. There's a few small groups here and there. But recently, I mean, there was a really massive prison break, a fairly sophisticated, coordinated attack on a prison that freed hundreds of al-Qaeda-linked militants. This is a very worrying sign. We saw a similar prison break in Pakistan. I think, I don't know if this is linked to the embassy closings, but it's definitely something to think about, something to worry about. As the situation in Syria deteriorates, these militants have a new place to gain ground, and it's definitely something to pay attention to.
I just want to play a piece of tape. Congressman Peter King on ABC this week describing what he sees the current strength of al-Qaeda.
This is a wake-up call. Al-Qaeda is in many ways stronger than it was before 9/11 because it's mutated and it's spread and it can come out of some different directions. And al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is probably the most deadly of all the al-Qaeda affiliates.
Do you agree with that assessment, stronger than it was pre-9/11?
You know, I think it's hard to say. I think the al-Qaeda of 9/11 and pre-9/11 was this, you know, singular kind of monolithic organization that was run by Osama bin Laden, now is headed by Ayman al-Zawahiri. Is that particular organization in control of all of these different attacks? No. You know, we know that they've splintered. We know that they've franchised. We know that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is based in Yemen, is kind of its own thing. It's kind of its own entity and has been for some time. So I don't know if that's really the assessment you want to make. Is it stronger or is it weaker?
And in Syria yesterday, you said Syria is now a place where these militants can go and gather. In Syria yesterday, rebels claimed a major airbase in the north of the country after months of fighting. Mm-hmm. Most of the reporting that I'm seeing says it was ultimately rebels with ties to al-Qaeda who secured the base. Other reports say it was a Saudi attacker who first started the battle at the airbase. Who are the rebels in Syria right now? Mm. Is it a functional coalition? Is this seizure of an airbase a demonstration that they are able to successfully work together? Or is it still very fractured?
They're able to successfully work together on the ground. Who are the rebels in Syria? That is the million-dollar question. They are hundreds, if not thousands, of different factions of groups working to bring down Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. What they would do after that is the question, and that's where they differ. Some of these are hardline jihadist Islamists with organizations called the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. These are guys, militants who came from Iraq, who've set up shop in Syria. There's another organization called Jabhat al-Nusra. They're extremists as well. Their goal is to establish an Islamic State in Syria, one that's sort of transnational, that goes into Iraq and Syria and everywhere else. And then you have other groups that are basically more moderate. I mean, these are people who pray and have beards, but they're people who want to set up something more akin to a pluralistic state that has, you know, elections. And so what do these guys do on the ground? Well, when they need to take an airbase, for instance, from Syrian troops, they work together. Does that mean that they share the same ideology? No. But does it mean that when the Islamists have You know, the hardline jihadis might have an anti-aircraft weapon to take down a plane or to shoot at a tank. They're going to say, yeah, let's work together to achieve this immediate sort of local objective, which is to take maybe this piece of territory or this base. So you see them working together all the time. But what is the larger goal? I think that's the problem. And I think what people worry about is what comes next. You know, it's like you can take these strategic points on the battlefield, but then what will you do when it comes to the big question? If this government is ever toppled, will there be a fight within the rebel movement? And I think we've seen a lot of that going on lately.
We'll play a bit of tape from your documentary about your coverage in Syria in just a minute. But I want to ask you, I mean, you've recently left the Middle East. But you still have many sources, and a hallmark of your reporting is just Syrians who are caught in the middle of this violence. Just describe what is the mood of everyday Syrians right now? We talk so much about who's winning, what's happening, whether there are going to be talks. What are people who are just in the middle of this feeling right now?
I can't. It's hard to explain. It's hard to really explain how miserable the situation is on the ground. You have millions and millions of people inside their own country displaced, not to mention the millions of people who've had to flee. I mean, there are now comparisons to, you know, the refugee crisis after Rwanda. I mean, we're talking about a major, major humanitarian crisis. And when you hear those words on the big scale from the people at the United Nations and stuff, I mean, those headlines kind of pass through the news. But what we tried to do in our reporting was just sort of get at the sense of what it means to be living this way. You know, you've got children who, when they draw pictures, can only draw in red because they think it's normal for people to bleed and die. You've got an enormous swath of the population that is so shell-shocked and so traumatized that they don't even really have a way to talk about what's happened to them. You know, we go and talk to Syrians all the time, and it's difficult to even hear their stories because they have such a hard time even talking about what's happened. A good friend of mine interviewed a 9-year-old boy who left Syria for Lebanon the other day. His parents had been killed. An uncle had promised to take him out of the country. The uncle was killed as they were getting in the truck. This kid is now living on the streets of Beirut, selling flowers. He's being run by a mafia. He has to earn his keep in some, you know, some shelter, basically paying whatever money he makes on the street. I mean, this is what's happening. And it's bad now. And the sense is that it's only going to get worse.
So you've done this documentary called Diary of a Bad Year about what it was like to be chronicling this, these people's lives as a conflict reporter. One of the techniques you used is that you narrated what was happening right in front of you to bring the listeners right there. Let's listen to a piece of tape from the documentary.
Okay, now we're hiding. Ah, Jesus Christ.
Oh my God.
They're shooting in the house. So, I mean, we're basically trapped in a kind of safe house right now. They are firing tear gas canisters at very close range. So if it hits a person, it can injure them. And the tear gas is horrible. It's one of those days, you know, where across the Arab world, people are getting tear gassed and beaten. And part of you is, like, feeling what they feel and knowing what they know is really important to be able to tell the story. But is it really worth it? I don't know.
So in that clip, there's so many things happening. You're in the midst of gunfire. You're hearing the fear not only in your own voice but in the people behind you whose language I don't understand because I don't speak Arabic. And you're also at the end narrating this question of, is this worth it? So just to start, I mean, you've recently made the decision to leave the Middle East to report domestically. We just talked about how unresolved the situation on the ground in Syria is. This documentary, you go into your ambivalence about conflict reporting, but just how do you feel today about having made the decision to leave that story while it's still very much unfolding?
Guilty, devastated, sad. There are times in your life when you know that, you know, your head knows what you're supposed to do and your heart doesn't want to do it. You know, I left a few days ago. I got to customs and the passport official said, you know, so you live in the Middle East? And I said, up until yesterday, yes, you know, and that was one of the hardest things I've ever had to say. I mean, it's one thing to sort of have a certain life and have a certain identity. It's another thing to feel very, very committed to a story and to the people you cover, these people that we're talking about who've seen so much hardship, characters who I've followed over the 2 years, 2+ years of the Syrian uprising, when it started as a protest movement, turned into sort of a rebellion, and is now devolving into a civil war. And there's people I've watched throughout that whole process. How can I just walk away from them? These are the things that are going through my mind. But, you know, there is a sense that you have to be able to tell that story. And if you get to a point where you're worrying and you have doubts and where your family is worried for you and you know that your safety is at stake, I mean, journalists are getting kidnapped left and right in Syria right now. 2012 was the deadliest year for journalists. Many of those deaths were in Syria. If you have a sense that there is going to be risk, maybe it's time to take a break, because maybe you're not the right person to tell the story. Maybe somebody else can tell the story. Maybe they can do it in different ways, different and safer ways. And that's sort of where I'm at right now. I have to be okay with it.
It's not all the time that you hear war reporters talking about these feelings of ambivalence about going towards the story. And I think one of the things the documentary explores is that you also have agency in making that choice. I mean, the people who live in Syria don't have the choice to not live in violence.
Right.
The people who serve in the armed forces don't have the choice if they're called up to serve on a mission. I want to play a piece of tape. You had a conversation with Sebastian Younger, about who's covered wars for many decades, about deciding his decision to stop covering conflict and what he was thinking about. And here's what he advised you.
I think you have to just be self-aware. You have to keep questioning yourself. What am I getting out of this? I'm about to go to Syria. What is it exactly I'm hoping to get out of this? And if you tell yourself, well, the Syrian people need this, like, that's true, but it's also really not why you're going. Sorry.
No.
And there's no shame in that. I mean, just be honest about it. Like, I'm going for myself. You know, partly for myself. Like, start by saying that.
What does that mean, you're going for yourself? I hear sort of that knowing giggle in that tape there. And that's not a very honorable thing to say.
Right. Yeah. And I think coming out of the closet about this has been fairly, you know, slightly controversial. But I think it's something we have to say, because we all know it. It's cool, you know, to go to war. It's exhilarating to be at the edge of life and death. There is something, Sebastian talks about it in the documentary. It's wonderful. You know, for tens of thousands of years, human beings were at the edge of life and death. And he says we have now kind of a genetic regret that, you know, going to the store, getting on the subway, that, you know, we are no longer facing matters of life and death. So when we can do that, we somehow feel like almost biologically fulfilled. It's cool. You get recognition. You know, I call it positive reinforcement for bad behavior. I have a little girl, so I think a lot about, like, positive and negative reinforcement. You get awards, you get raises, you get lots of praise. And I think while it's not that it's not deserved, that you have risked something to tell important stories, I think you also have to kind of check that and remember why it is you're there. You know, are you there for yourself? Like Sebastian says, you have to admit that. And are you there for the people and the people whose stories you're telling? And when that balance sort of starts to tip and you see it being more about you, maybe it's time to step back.
So you mentioned just then that you're a mother, so you have a family.
Mm-hmm.
You also explore in the documentary that it's called Diary of a Bad Year, and it's not just your bad year. It's a bad year for war reporters. And you talk about watching your colleagues die. Tell me about how that framed how you thought about wanting to tell this story. I mean, is it in part to try to some way hold up with what they were doing?
Yeah, definitely. It's a tribute to them. Anthony Shadid, New York Times reporter who died in Syria. Marie Colvin, Times of London reporter who died in Syria. Remy Oklik, who died with her. Chris Hondros and Tim Hetherington, who died in Libya, and all the Syrians and the Libyans who died in 2011 and 2012 when their Arab uprisings turned into civil conflicts, is definitely a tribute to them. I mean, watching, there's no question that going to those funerals and sitting and crying with colleagues and having to see, you know, for instance, the child of who was about the same age as my child, of Anthony, you know, after he died, and wondering what kind of life he's going to have, had an effect on me, had an effect on my family. You know, my parents watch CNN. They know what's going on. They know what's at stake. And I think one of the things I try to explore in the documentary is this sense that, you know, when something like that happens, we all grieve, we mourn, we talk about the risks, we being the tribe of foreign correspondents who do this. But there's also this weird pivot that you do where you think, oh, but that won't happen to me because I won't be as stupid as this person was, because I'll use this other fixer and I'll use this other road. And, you know, you kind of go into this world of denial where you can convince yourself and sometimes your bosses that whatever bullet got them will somehow go around you, because that's what you have to do to get up and do this job every morning. You have to be in a certain level of denial. So I think the fact that so many of these deaths did happen, I think it just kind of cracked that wall of denial, at least for me.
And cracking that wall of denial, I mean, in the radio documentary, you end it with a letter that you write in the event that you are killed while reporting in a conflict zone. You write it to your husband and to your daughter. Did writing that letter make you decide you didn't want to do it anymore?
It didn't, but it got me down the road. You know, deciding to leave will be one of the hardest things I've ever done. I think a lot of this process was just putting the things in motion to sort of force myself to do it. The letter was an interesting thing. You know, I had talked to other journalists and I had talked to former soldiers who work as security consultants, and they said, look, you know, if you're in the military, you know exactly what you're getting yourself into. You know what's at stake. When you leave home, you say goodbye as if it could be the last time. You write that letter. You get your insurance all in order. You have it all sorted out. You know what you're going to, you know, how this is going to go. I mean, it's not pleasant, but you do it. And journalists don't do that. You know, in the documentary, I talked to the BBC's Paul Wood. He's covered dozens of conflicts. He's got five children. And he was advised to write such a letter, and he won't do it. He actively, like, says, I won't do it, because to do so would be to admit what's really at stake, you know, and to even just sit down and write that would just be too hard. And so when he said that to me, I thought, oh, God, I couldn't do it either. But, you know, by the end of it, I knew that it was the responsible thing to do. I was going to Aleppo, which was at the time, you know, a major front line in the Syrian conflict. I wanted to go. There were stories I wanted to tell. But I also knew that Scud missiles and airstrikes and shells and, you know, rockets were falling on the city all the time, that, you know, anything could happen. So the responsible thing to do was to sit down and write that letter. Did it change my mind at the time? No. But did it just help me take one step toward really coming face to face with all this? Yeah. And I'm glad it did.
Kelly McEvers is an NPR correspondent, most recently reporting on Syria and serving as Beirut bureau chief. Her new documentary, produced with Transom, is called Diary of a Bad Year. You can listen to it and download the full piece on our website. Go to WNYC.org, click on The Brian Lehrer Show. And Kelly McEvers will be at Union Docks in Brooklyn this Friday. More info on our website. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck.
You're welcome. Thanks.
After the break, we're going to talk about other people who have to prepare their families when they're going into conflict. We'll talk about the latest survey of veterans who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm Anna Sale in for Brian Lehrer. More after the break.